The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. If there were a president of the world and he were to report on the state of the world, if he were responsible for all human destiny and we're now reporting to a universal parliament this year, what would he say? Just what would be the state of the world message in this second decade of the United Nations? Here would be the most succinct facts that he could lay before all the peoples of the world, from Africa to Malaysia, and from South America to Great Britain. 60%, he would have to say, of the Earth's land surface is arid or semi-arid, and this area is capable of supporting only 5% of the world's population. Then he would say the inhabitants of the Earth now number 3 billion, and at the present rate of increase will number 6 billion by the end of the 20th century. More than half, he would report, of the world's present population suffers from varying degrees of malnutrition. The increase of food production is not keeping pace with population growth, and we're headed for trouble in that direction. Then he would have to tell you about life expectancy, which, while it reaches an average of 70 years in some developed countries, drops to only a mere 30 years in parts of Asia and Africa. Some 500 million people are afflicted, he would say, by waterborne diseases for which remedies or preventative techniques exist. Some 700 million adults throughout the world can't read, can't write, can't spell out their own names for you, including 80% of the total population of Africa and 60 to 65% of the population of Asia. Then he would come to economics and cultural opportunities, and he would say that actually the disparities between them are already vast and they are growing wider. The most advanced countries are 3,000% more prosperous than the least advanced, and the effects of science, industry, technology, and progress are still largely confined to the advanced countries, which contain less than a quarter of the human race. So here we are with only a tiny few enjoying a large, giant, glittering sort of a Disneyland of pleasure, of booming and prosperous economy, of plenty of pastimes, plenty of leisure moments, and higher living, higher income, higher standards than ever before. But a great and a growing, vast, teeming percentage of the world having less and less and drifting into more and more abject poverty. Then he would have to report on how a great migration is underway today, almost like a gigantic exodus from villages to cities, and is going forward across this globe under conditions that increase the peril to health and social stability. Then he would have to tell you a little about what is happening inside of those cities as a result of this mass exodus of people leaving the land and coming into cities and the tremendous packed conditions that exist. Then he would have to mention how some of the world's natural resources are nearing depletion, how water is getting harder to obtain, and more of it is becoming more and more polluted, how big nations that presently have the money even find it too costly and too expensive to in any way use seawater so as to really provide tremendous sections of the country with it at a decent cost. And the Earth's atmosphere, he would have to tell you, and many water sources are being poisoned by wholesale pollution. Then he would have to say there's been absolutely no lessening whatsoever of the arms race, and little progress in evolving agreed forms of international security. He would have to tell you about wanton violation of rational priorities. He would have to talk about a world that spends over $300 million every single day on armaments and couldn't even begin to find $300 million a year to maintain an organization for the defense of peace. How about that? What a comparison. $300 million a year is what they would like to budget for the United Nations and a few other things that would help bring peace. At least they think it would help bring peace. Now, that's another moot question. But we're spending over $300 million a day around the world on armaments. Then he would have to tell you how it's easier to budget funds any day to invade the moon than it would be to save the Earth for urgent human needs. How can issues of such scope be surveyed, still less solved, except in a global arena? In a giant area of conflict. Then he would have to report how it is true that the United Nations specialized agencies and conferences bring a universal vision to bear on the torment and hopes of mankind, but they have never yet discussed them at a level of authority capable of yielding decisive action. Oh, there are plenty of booklets published and printed, The problems are talked over and discussed. People report on appalling conditions. Some of the documentation and the statistical evidence of the way some people live in the world and even the problems among the so-called have-nations would almost stand your hair on end. And there are all kinds of meetings and they're sort of chewing the rag about it and hashing it over and talking about it. Beautiful printing, fabulous color, terrific bindings, lovely books. You can buy all kinds of information about the problems of the world. But have those problems ever been discussed at a level which would mean their solution is imminent? Has anyone ever taken them up at a level of authority capable of yielding a real decisive action and solving the problem? Summit meetings still take a microscopic view of a couple or three of the problems, of which there are thousands, and maybe the couple or three problems are even then the direct result of one people's or one nation's particular national goals, such as, for example, a divided Germany, or the Berlin Wall, or the problems in Europe, or the Pescadores, or Vietnam, or Cuba, or something else. But what about the great, gigantic, almost unbelievable problems of the world on the human scene at large? Yes, this would be his report, a panoramic view of the complete and total human scene. Then he would say, now, other than that, we're in pretty good shape. Other than that, everything's fine. I think you get what I mean, don't you? Now, what would be his projections in the light of these facts and these statistics for the future? What hope, what great expectancy, what courage would he leave in your mind after reading such a report, after it reached your ears wherever you live in your part of the world? What would be his prognostications and his predictions for the future? Would he tell you that we're only 5 years from solving our racial tensions and bigotries? We're only about 2 years from uncovering vast natural resources to replace our depleted ones? Why, we're standing right on the brink right now of educating billions. Why, we're right now just trembling on the brink of solving the gigantic problems in people's minds morally, prejudicially, racially, through illiteracy and ignorance, and of course religiously, about this thing of the population explosion and birth control. We're just now trembling on the brink of solving all of our difficulties between the various big political powers and the emerging new power blocks. Why, Mr. Sukarno is just ready to lay down all of his claims against the Philippines and Australia. Look at Cuba down there. Why, Mr. Castro is ready to shave his beard and clean up and put on some decent clothes and throw away his fatigues. And he's going to quit preaching hatred and starting to spread all kinds of venomous uprisings around through the Caribbean and Central and South American area. Why, the United States is willing to give away about half of what it... Well, it really is, as far as that's concerned, I guess. I was going to say give away about half of what it has to all the impoverished and underprivileged nations. Japan and China are going to shake hands and get along. China and Russia are going to get along. China's going to quit looking truculent and belligerent on the world scene and start cooperating with all other peoples, open up its borders, break down the bamboo barrier, the bamboo curtain. The Iron Curtain's coming down. The Berlin Wall's going to be torn down tomorrow. Everybody's going to be happy. Would he be able to report all of that? Would he be able to tell you no more strikes? Would he be able to tell you higher wages for everybody, free education? What would be his predictions for the future? Now, on the slightest level, even in your own private life, in your own private family, whatever it might mean to you, would he tell you there's some free land available someplace? What would his predictions be for your children, their education? What about the security of the world in the near future? What is around the corner? Well, my friends, in the light of such a report, as any fanciful world president would have to report, if he were to look at all of the available accurate facts about the state of the world today, and he were to report to you about this world today, that would be his report. But what would be his predictions? It's time you quit deluding yourself into believing that you can dodge into your own ready-made daydreams and day-to-day pursuits and think about the vacation and the summer's trip and the camping out, and you can think about some minor pursuit of your own, and somehow if you pull yourself into your own hole and then pull it in after you deep enough and blind your eyes and your mind from reality, then you won't have to look at the world around you, and maybe others will solve the problem, and maybe you won't have to. You are going to witness a series of the greatest calamities in the experience of man. You're going to witness the death throes of civilization. You yourself are going to see a world that is going to go through the greatest series of social, political, economic, cultural, educational, military revolutions that has ever been remotely envisioned in the wildest nightmares of the greatest demented and tormented man who wakes up screaming with his fears at night. It is so inexplicable, so absolutely indescribable, so unbelievable, your mind wouldn't grasp it. You couldn't reach out and begin to grasp or to comprehend or understand the throes and the gigantic heavings, the turmoil and the revolutions, the unbelievable wars toward which we are right now unalterably headed unless some totally unforeseen, unprepared for, unpredicted and unexpected occurrence from an outside source. No force, no power, no source that is presently working, but an outside source beyond the mind and the notions and the ideas of man were to intervene and to stop us short of such a horrifying nightmare. Now, everybody's getting into the act. I mean, the greatest religious leaders on the face of the earth, the greatest political leaders, the greatest greats are all saying it. For instance, not long ago, Pope Paul had made an impassioned plea to world leaders to stop what he called the fresh flames of discord from erupting into a major war, and he said they better do it while there's still time. He said another world war would be the end of civilization. And he's not the only one who said it. Plenty of others have. So when I tell you the statistical facts about the state of the world, I'm not kidding. Those are the facts. That's the way it is. But now what about the future? What is ahead for humanity? It's about time you knew why. About time you knew the way out and where there is protection and safety for you and yours. Did human beings in all of our races, languages, nations, and religions just happen? Are we just accidents, happenstances? Are we the result of bizarre caprice? Or is the human mind and the human being a planned creature? Is there a reason for our being and our existence on this earth? And can you discover that reason and that purpose? Because unless there is a reason, unless there is a purpose, then the only prognostication that would make any sense at all looking at the plain truth of today's world would be a prediction of disaster unparalleled, a foretelling of world suicide. And we can kid ourselves all we wish. We can jump in our campers and roar off to the national forest if we like. That isn't, unfortunately, going to change the state of affairs in the world. We can take our trips and our honeymoons and our summer's vacation, and we can get away from it all. We can run into the little escape of our own private-made daydreams in our own homes. We can sit and absorb television. We can be like the fellow who chewed his big fat cigar and said, "Let the world come to an end while I'm watching Gunsmoke." We can have a fatalistic idea, but that isn't going to solve it. It's not going to change it. And when it gets right down to it, when the chips are down, the fellow would probably swallow his cigar and jump up and run screaming and wish that he hadn't said it that way. My friends, is there a God? Meanwhile, you know, while everybody's talking about problems and solutions, and maybe there aren't any solutions, is there a God? Is there really a God? And I mean a no-kidding kind of a God. I don't mean an idea, first cause, vague idea about the light that is in grass and trees. I don't mean the idea of children, such as an old man with a beard or a man with tattered clothing and a helpful grandfather. I do not mean the God of so many people who even go to church and claim to believe in Jesus Christ, because I don't mean the God who has gone way off, who is out of touch, who is unreal, who is disconnected and unattached to the world and its goings-on. I mean the God of Jesus Christ, the God who created mankind, who claims to have created him at least, who claims to have made every force and energy and power, the God who says every great nation is just like a drop in the bucket before him. I mean the God who reveals himself in the Bible, if there is such a God. Now, is there such a God? And if you were to begin to research and try to prove it, would you meet with any success? Is there any way you could actually start on a study, which wouldn't take you too long, would be rather simple? Because, let's face it, most people are basically lazy and don't want to spend an awful lot of time in doing that type of thing anyhow. But let's say it were enough of a piquant question that it really bothered you enough and were a big enough question to you that you would like to know what method you could pursue that wouldn't take a lot of time, but you'd begin to get some tangible facts and you could sink your teeth into them and you would know that they're not kidding, that it's something that you can believe in just as much as you believe as sure as you sit there and pinch your nose you're going to get blood. All right, there is such a way. And that way is to write for a couple of free booklets that will start you on that way. Now, they're going to prove it to you if your mind is open. But they'll also point out some other proofs. And plenty of them you can try and test for yourself. And they're entitled, Does God Exist? And the Proof of the Bible. They're free of charge, and I'll give you the address at the close of this program. You can write for them. Was there really any inspiration behind this great challenge that was flung out here in the 40th chapter of the book of Isaiah centuries ago? Was there a great being who inspired these words, or was this an ancient man with a long beard sitting in the dust alongside a river somewhere, scribbling on a tablet, who sort of had a grandiose idea or a daydream, and sort of felt lifted up and big and inspired on this particular day, and so wrote a lot of things because he was mad at humanity? A lot of people envision something sort of like a comic strip that is appearing in the United States called BC. Here's somebody sitting in a cave with a pair of stark, staring eyes, and they think that maybe that's the way this prophet Isaiah was. Maybe running around in the wilderness naked, you know, with all kinds of hallucinations and visions, and somebody got some of his wild ravings and made it a part of the Bible. Is that true, and can you prove it? Well, at any rate, whoever wrote it and whoever said it and however it got there, there is something here in the 40th chapter of Isaiah that's rather challenging. It calls out before all nations and says some rather embarrassing things. A pretty good-sized gauntlet thrown down here. Anyone willing to take it up? You willing to check it? Willing to look into it? He says in verse 12 of the 40th chapter of Isaiah, Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and meted out heaven with a span and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who has directed the spirit of the eternal or being his counselor has taught him? With whom took he counsel and who instructed him and taught him in the path of judgment and taught him knowledge and showed to him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket, and are counted as the small dust of the balance. He considers or takes up the coastlands as a very little thing. And he said in verse 17, All nations before him are as nothing, and they're counted to him less than nothing and vanity. Now, do you know very much about astronomy? You know, of course, that we call our own particular galaxy the Milky Way. That's not a candy bar. It's a series of billions of stars. Now, the only star in our solar system is the Sun. And the Sun represents about 90-some percent of the total cubic space of our solar system, including all the space in, around, among, and between the nine planets, the Earth, the Moon, all the moons of Mars and the rest of them, and plus the Sun itself. Yet there is such a vast distance between the Earth and the Sun so as to just stagger the imagination. But this is only one part of our galaxy, because all those other suns, of which there are millions and millions of them in the galaxy alone, many of those are so much bigger than our sun, there's no comparison. Now, you could drop the world and Mars and Jupiter and Neptune and Mercury and Pluto and the Earth and the Moon and all the moons of the other planets and Saturn, and you could sort of open a little hole in the top of the sun and drop them all inside like a great big globe, and they would sort of clink around down there like little grains of sand in comparison. But, my friends, our sun, which is the only star of the solar system, is a dwarf star, they tell us, in comparison with other stars. It's a little tiny dwarf. It's one of the little dwarf stars. But the big giants and then the super giants are so many times greater and bigger than our sun, so as to practically be not even a decent or a suitable comparison. And yet our galaxy is only one galaxy. Now, I've drawn this simple representation before, that space and these vast giant suns, remember that each one of these suns could have, conceivably, a solar system. But they are so bright and so brilliant, you couldn't see planets around them because their brilliance would so make all of the planets appear back in the shadows that you couldn't even tell whether they are there or not. So what you look up and see in the sky at night, with the exception of some of the planets that are close enough to the Earth to still reflect the light from our sun, all you see, those stars, and the nearest one is called Alpha Centauri. That is, other than our own sun. All you see are other vast, huge suns, great, glowing, exploding, gigantic orbs of gas, each time, each split second, giving off explosions like the gigaton atomic and hydrogen bombs, thousands of times bigger, sometimes great solar loops and prominences of gas going up millions of miles into space.
clear across the orbit of the Earth and Mars and back again, just a loop of fire on the surface of that sun. Unbelievable, you might say. Oh, no, it's not. It's true. It's factual. You can weigh it. You lie out on the beach and you sun. But do you ponder, as you lie there, what got that big giant body up there in the sky and what keeps it there? Are you living on a round Earth? Are there other people 8,000 miles straight through from you? Now, just before you scoff and sort of get a big joke out of all this and think there isn't a God, just think about it for a minute. Give it a chance so that you give yourself at least a moment's sane and logical and balanced thought. We can kid ourselves all we wish, but our logical, rational human minds demand an explanation for some things, and just as much as we see that we weren't here and the world was still going on without us, and just as much as we know our grandparents weren't here and that life came from someplace, we know that this great sun had to have a beginning. We know that it's running down, it's giving off in explosions and burning gases much of its power. It's not losing very much, and yet it's losing more than the combined explosive force and energies of I don't know how many billions of atomic bombs every single day. And yet it seems hardly ever to run down. Well, now, interstellar space, the distance between great stars, has been likened to a simple experiment. It might be called simple, and yet is it really? Just think of this for a moment and see if your mind can even comprehend it. Now, taking 1 cubic inch of water, that's, you can just put your fingers together in a little square. It's a cube, 1 inch up, 1 inch thick, and 1 inch through. All right, 1 cubic inch of water, and then putting that in a container and boiling it until it completely vaporizes into steam, and then taking that steam from that 1 cubic inch and hurling it, by some means, through 40 trillion miles of cubic space. Now, each one of those infinite, microscopic, little, tiny, invisible droplets of steam, and when you scatter them, you won't even see them, likened even to the moisture in the air on a humid day, would represent one of the supergiants or one of the giant stars and the space between each of them, and this is in, by the way, 40 trillion miles of space, would represent interstellar space. Now, I submit to you that if there is a God, and if the God I'm talking about made all of that, if he created all of that and even made your mind and made your body and started life and put it on this earth, then it's rather logical to me to see why God would have the attitude he does toward nations and peoples on the earth, and why he would say the nations are as a drop of a bucket. They're a bunch of vanity, a little pip in the middle of a whirlwind, one drop out of the ocean. They're like one tiny little speck of dust on the left rear leg of a microbe who is on the right wing of a flea which is walking on a dog which is lost in the middle of the African jungles. I mean, what comparison would you draw? When God speaks with all of his authority and says, all nations before him are as nothing, and they're counted to him less than nothing in vanity, that's a pretty good-sized challenge. Now, little men with a piece of plasterboard on their head can stand up and actually shake their fist at God, and that's the proof God exists, because he allows it. To them, it's proof he doesn't exist, because he doesn't strike them dead. But, of course, if he did, right on the spot, it wouldn't prove a thing to them. They'd be dead, and they wouldn't know anything else. To whom, then, he said in verse 18 of Isaiah 40, will you liken God? Yes, to whom? Well, I'll tell you to whom. Babies, boys, and girls liken God to their fathers and grandfathers. Idiot painters liken God to other people, I guess, with long beards. And pagans liken God to suns, moons, stars, growing things, or animals. Yes, the finks of yesteryear, the idiots and the demented peoples of times past have given a lot of so-called modern intellects a lot of excuses, haven't they? Because they see people bowing toward the east and worshiping the sun at its rising. And they see that the sun and photosynthesis and the producing of oxygen, and they see the life-giving qualities of the sun and the growing of plants, and so on, and so they begin to reason that maybe the sun is God. So they worship the sun. Or they'll worship each other, or they'll worship an idea. They come up with pantheism or all-ism or whatever. They just believe God is a sort of a great force. All that is a bunch of vanity. All that is a bunch of sort of half-thought-out, vague, nebulous, gray, wistful, sort of foggy notions in the back of somebody's mind that isn't really truly sharp and educated, and it's just sort of a self-satisfying probing of your own interior, your own intellect, that you think sort of satisfies your vanity. But God Almighty says you can prove whether or not he exists. Now, he goes on to say in verse 19, the workman melts the graven image, and the goldsmith spreads it over with the gold and casts silver chains. He that is so impoverished that he has no oblation chooses a tree. That's the best he can do. It will not rot, so he'll use teak, or he'll use ebony, or he'll use redwood, or something else. And then, of course, he will fashion it, and he'll bow down to it. As God says in verse 25, to whom then will you liken me, or shall I be equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high, and behold, who has created these things? Now, you afraid to ask a few questions? Why don't you lift your eyes up on high? You can get out away from the smog and the bright lights of the city. Now, bright lights come from water rushing through great paddles, which in turn turn dynamos, which cause friction, which then is stored in batteries, or which comes to you and is transformed down into a usable current, which has to flow in a circuitous course and go back to its source from which it came. But, of course, we get rather dazzled by bright lights. We forget where they come from. Muddy river water. Friction. We forget about some of the basic essentials of life itself and some of the great proofs from scientific sources of just logical thought, of taking anything we use back to its elementary, rudimentary beginnings and ask, yes, but where do the materials come from? What about the laws and the forces and the energies? What puts them into force? What makes them act? Why does it occur that way? He says, lift up your eyes, take a look above you, and see who has created these things that brings out their host by number. He calls them all by names. We haven't even discovered them all yet. We're not quite sure how many there are out there, but he's got them all named. By the greatness of his might, for he is strong in power, and not one fails. Now, is that God talking? That says he sits upon the circle of the earth and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers. He says, produce your cause, bring forth your strong reason, show us what will happen, show us the former things. He challenges us to predict the future when he says he's already done it. Is that God talking, or was that a fellow in a cave with a long beard that sort of got a real good notion one day and wrote a lot of ideas? Would there be any way you, whether you're a truck driver, a salesman, a businessman, a military man, or what have you, could tangibly and successfully prove it to yourself? Would you be willing to give it the time of day just to check and find out? If you are, and if you're not afraid of what you might find, then write for the booklets, Does God Exist? And the Proof of the Bible. And then also write for this booklet. We'll send it to you by return mail, absolutely free of charge, with the up-to-the-minute information on the space race and the absolute bona fide biblical prophetical predictions about the outcome, because who is going to win it is already revealed, and military men tell us that whoever gets power over space and the moon, and that's already been decided, is already clear cut. The actual ruler of space is already known, and they say whoever does it is going to rule the world. So you write for that booklet, Who Will Rule Space? It's in full color, and there are a lot of things about the universe and things I've been talking about in this program, even pictures and comparisons in this booklet. So write for it. It's free of charge, no price, and request the Plain Truth magazine as well. They're all absolutely free. There is no charge, no follow-up, no request for money. Send your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. No one's going to call on you. It's free of charge. If you send your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California, be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.